Edition. I'm Nina Keck, in for Jane Lindholm. In recent months, we've been shocked and horrified by film footage taken by body cameras and dash cams during encounters with police. In Charlotte, North Carolina this month, rioting erupted after the fatal shooting of Keith Scott. While officers there used body cameras, crucial evidence is still not available because one of the officers failed to activate his camera as soon as he responded, a violation of department policy. Here in Vermont, civil rights groups are urging law enforcement to release body camera footage related to a fatal shooting of an unarmed man in downtown Winooski this month. Police have not released that footage, saying it's evidence in an ongoing investigation and won't be made public until the investigation is complete. Today on Vermont Edition, we'll talk about the multi-layered issues surrounding the use of body cameras by police. My guests today include Lieutenant Gary Scott. He's commander of the Vermont State Police Williston Barracks, and he chaired the state police's pilot program that tested out the use of body cameras. Lieutenant Scott, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you for having me.
Leah Ernst is a staff attorney for the Vermont ACLU. She joins us from our studios in Montpelier. Leah, thanks for being on the program.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And Stan Chernock is a professor of criminal justice and director of the School of Justice Studies and Sociology at Norwich University. Welcome to you, Stan. Thanks for being on the program.
Thank you, Nina.
So, listeners, what do you think about body cameras? Do you think police need them to ensure transparency in their interactions with the public? How would it feel if you called the police and the officer who responded at your front door told you she'd be recording the encounter? And what about the cost? Lots of questions today. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page or go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. Lieutenant Scott, let me start with you. Talk about the pilot program you led for the state police to test an in-car, on-person camera system. What were your goals?
So we wanted to try different types of systems that are out there to see how they would hold up in the weather conditions and different environmental factors that we deal with here in Vermont. We wanted to see how the troopers would react to having them while they were on routine patrol. We had them in night shift and day shift, so we had a total of 9 troopers throughout the state that were selected to use them. They overwhelmingly enjoyed having them, and we ultimately decided on one product that we thought would work the best for us.
And just to be clear, state police have been using dash cams for years in their cruisers, so this is kind of just an extension of that, correct?
That's correct. We started using in-car cameras in 1999 is when our policy went into effect. So we've had them for a significant amount of time. So it's just the next step in the process. And we welcome having them. The troopers are excited to have them, and we want to figure out a way to make it work.
So Burlington police are now using body cameras. Do you know how many other police departments in Vermont are using or testing body cameras?
I'm not sure of that number, no.
Leah Ernst, let me ask you, as someone who fights for civil liberties, how do you balance the needs for transparency, the fact that people want to be able to show what really happens in a police encounter, with someone's right to privacy? You know, if you call the police, do you want the officer who comes to your home to film that encounter and to perhaps make it available to the public? Can you have both?
Well, these are very difficult questions, which is why we only support the use of body cams if they're accompanied by very clear and very thorough policies that in advance seek to address these difficult balances that you refer to. And so if you're going to use body cams, there are several requirements that we think any reasonable policy must encompass, including clear direction on when the camera goes on and when it goes off, the ability for people to consent or withhold consent to being filmed, particularly if they're in their own home or if they're a victim or a vulnerable witness, and things like this that really seek to address these very, very difficult balances. I think what we saw in the aftermath of these police shootings and all the unrest was a rush to embrace body cams as a panacea. And I think that was done with good intentions, but unfortunately it was done without proper or really any policies in some cases guiding their use.
Well, and I understand laws governing the use of these body cameras vary from state to state, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I understand Vermont right now is trying to figure out exactly what its policy is going to be.
That is exactly correct. And in that process, The committee involved is reviewing policies adopted by various agencies as well as model policies put forth by, for example, the International Association of the Chiefs of Police. The ACLU has a model policy that obviously we feel very strongly about. And so I think there are a lot of policies out there that can really provide some guidance in best and worst practices.
Well, we'll dig into that in just a few minutes, but I want to bring Stan Chernock into the conversation. As a professor of criminal justice, how do you see this balancing act between personal privacy and the public's right to see a complete police interaction?
Well, I think the issue involves more than that. Actually, you have the larger community who are also in support of body cameras, besides police officers at the present time. I think that the privacy issues are very legitimate concerns. When you're considering privacy issues, though, and you're talking about turning cameras on and off, this actually creates a great deal of discretion for police. It becomes a more difficult enterprise than maintaining the cameras on the entire time. I think that you need to consider that as well, and you need to consider the particular type of situations under which body cameras are absolutely incumbent to use. But besides the civil liberties of those people who are being searched by police, confronted by police, you also have community concerns and you have law enforcement officer concerns. There's only been research recently on concerns by law enforcement officers, which do find that law enforcement officers are very enthusiastic about body cams. There hasn't been that much regarding the community, although there have been outcries recently after these incidents for body cams. I'll be talking about the research later, and I'll be talking about body cameras versus other methods of dealing with some of the recent problems.
Well, again, listeners, we're talking about the pros, the cons, the questions of police body cameras today on Vermont Edition. Our number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to the phone lines now and talk with Michael, who's calling from Burlington. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead.
Sure. My comment is on one basis alone, and that is you referenced the cost of these cameras. Mm-hmm. I think that recently these cameras have been used to show that the police haven't always acted in a civilian or a community's best interest. And I don't really think it's fair to compare the cost of a camera to the cost of a human life. I think we need to be really appropriate with how we frame these issues.
So, Michael, it sounds like you're in favor of using these cameras and think they're well worth the investment.
Yes, ma'am.
All right.
And
thank you.
Can we mention cost? Actually, a lot of the cost will be paid by the federal government. In fact, in the past presidential debate, candidate Hillary Clinton suggested that this would be one of the ways to reform criminal justice, by contributing federal money to body cams. Actually, our current president, President Obama, also has contributed 50,000 body cameras. So this is going to be a source of funding for body cameras in the future.
Well,
excuse me.
Well, I was just going to say, let me ask Lieutenant Scott to talk about specifics when it comes to cost. He was mentioning they were testing out a particular product. How much were the cameras that you were trying out, Lieutenant?
So we wanted a system that would work hand-in-hand with the in-car camera and the body camera system. So an in-car camera system is about $5,000, and the body camera would be about $1,200 to work together. So that's the rough cost that we see. We did explore federal funding. Federal grants come with a lot of stipulations and a lot of things you have to comply with in order to be able to obtain that money. So those are avenues that we have explored. Our commissioner is going to be looking at adding this as a line item to the upcoming budget. So as of right now, we do not have an identified funding source, but we continue to look everywhere we can because this is a high priority and we do have a sincere desire to be as transparent as possible.
How much would the total cost be to outfit all of the state troopers with these dash and body cams?
So the initial cost to get us all up and running, to get all the barracks with the hardware and the software needed, would be about $1.2 million, $1.4 million in that range. And then the back-end costs, you know, depending upon the style of system that you use, when you have a the frames per second, you know, the technology-based solutions that we'd have to look at, that increases costs because that increased data and storage. Mm-hmm. So the back end is something we have to really look at. We tested it one way. You know, when we were making an arrest, we may want to have a higher resolution, but when we're talking to someone in a non-criminal complaint, we could use a lower resolution. So those are things we'd have to incorporate into our training and then hopefully could save on the back-end solution. So we are not quite sure what the back-end cost of this would be with our storage.
Well, and Dennis wrote in, how are the recordings preserved or stored, and who decides what's kept? How long is it kept? Is this treated like the old street cop notebook? And I think that is an interesting question. Let me bring Leah Ernst back into the conversation. You know, to have all of these encounters stored, do you think that there's an issue there where people will want to access them like they might access any other evidence related to a case?
Sure. I mean, I think these tapes are undeniably public records, subject to the state's public records law. And As currently written, there are exemptions from disclosure for various law enforcement purposes, including protecting the privacy of individuals, if it could interfere with an ongoing investigation and that sort of thing. I think the existing public records law draws an appropriate balance between when these ought to be released in the public interest and when there is justification for the police to withhold the videos for some period of time.
Well, and that's a really interesting question that you bring up when we talk about an ongoing criminal investigation. A lot of times we've heard police departments say they're not going to release video evidence or video camera footage of a particular incident because of ongoing criminal investigations. Stan Chernock, why can that get in the way? What's the big question or concern that releasing the video will hurt a case?
Well, usually it's going to be some type of bias until the investigation's completed. I don't see a problem. The material will be, especially if it's going to court, the data will be released at that particular time. So I don't really see too much of a problem. There's been kind of a clamor at the present time, particularly in this Winooski case, for releasing the footage. And I don't think it's really necessary until the investigation is completed. I think that's a concern not to bias the case in any way. I think eventually, in any type of case, it will be. If there's a suit, too, I believe, and I might be corrected, that it would definitely be open to view.
Listeners, if you're just tuning in, we're talking about the use of police body cameras, how well they work, and how and when camera footage should be released to the public. You can weigh into the discussion by calling 1-800-639-2211. It's 1-800-639-2211, or go to vpr.net/Vermont Edition. There was an interesting study. The Rialto, California Police Department took part in one of the very first studies on the use of body cameras. And there were some fascinating findings, namely use of force incidents dropped by 59% and citizen complaints against the police dropped by 88%. Lieutenant Scott, let me ask you, one of the issues that people talked about with this study is self-awareness, the self-awareness effect of having cameras on and how that affects both the behavior of the police and the people they're dealing with. What did you find when you were piloting this here in Vermont?
We didn't see much change in behavior from our troopers or the public. It's typical interactions. A lot of the interactions the troopers had were at night when they were making arrests with, you know, in regards to impaired driving. It didn't change the behavior. Our troopers are accustomed to having these videos going, so that it was sort of normal for them from the start of their career. So we didn't see a dramatic change that way.
And Stan Chernock, you
yes.
obviously are familiar with this. What other interesting
yes.
research did this find?
There's been other studies which have, in fact, replicated this study. It's an important study because it wasn't just a study of police officers who are using cameras. It was a controlled empirical study with randomized trials, which is extremely important. You had officers who did not have cameras as versus officers who did have cameras. That's extremely important because there's been a number of studies that have not that have been done that don't meet empirical standards. And this study was a very careful study done by Cambridge University. And what they basically did would use randomized cases where the person had the camera and person did not have the camera. And the findings were very, very strong. Officers tend, and there's been some studies on how officers perceived how, in fact, the cameras would affect them. They tend to view the cameras not affecting them personally, but affecting others in the department. They're likely to say that, you know, that they're doing things correctly at the present time. However, that they did assume in one study that was done in Orlando, Florida, that other officers would behave differently. And we have found in the studies that have been done, and there have been some reviews of the literature, that cameras have had a very positive and very strong effect on both the use of force and also the number of citizen complaints. This is just one of about 5, 6, 8 studies that have been done that I've just reviewed, and I'm not an expert in this area. And they all point in the same direction, that the cameras have had a very positive effect.
Well, I'm also curious how the cameras might affect the public. Leah Ernst, I don't know if you can answer this, but I'm curious your take on it. Do you think that if police officers have cameras, might that affect the willingness of people to call the police department to seek help?
Well, I think if the policies allow for the complainants to give or withhold consent when being filmed, I think that largely mitigates those concerns. And I really want to get back actually to something that Professor Charnock said earlier, because I think it's critically important. He referenced the public clamor for the release of the footage from Minuski. And
I didn't give you a chance to respond to that. Go ahead.
So the one of the fundamental reasons for having body cams is to start to rebuild the trust between police and the communities. And when we're only receiving a description of the video without the video itself, people are naturally skeptical of just trust us requests. And when we're asked to trust without being able to verify, it feeds into the simmering mistrust that unfortunately is very present today. And that trust goes both ways. And what we're hearing, what we're feeling in this instance is that the police don't trust us, the public, to view these videos ourselves and to come to reasoned and rational conclusions. And the sort of rote recitation of it deals with the investigation of a crime and therefore we can't release it just rings hollow when at this point the statements have been taken, the video has been viewed, and we've been given no justification for why actually the release of the video would interfere with the investigation.
Well, what about the concerns that have been raised that if people that may end up being part of a case or a trial later see these videos in the early stages and it affects how they remember the event, is that any concern to you, or is that a legitimate question, that it may change people's memories?
Absolutely. I think that's critical, and that's exactly why we feel very strongly that witnesses, including the officers involved, should not be able to view the footage before giving their initial statements. We know more and more that memory is very malleable, and an outside source can dramatically affect what a person, quote-unquote, remembers from the event. And so there's no reason to expose officers or witnesses to these outside influences before they give their initial statements.
I would second that. I think legitimacy is important, too. But I think there are, even though they are videos, there's still interpretations of the videos, and I think that the internal investigation is viewing those, as are the prosecutors at the present time. I would just strongly support the eventual release of those videos. I think I totally agree that it's, that this whole idea about body-worn cameras is related to legitimacy and trust. They definitely should be released eventually. But initially in the investigation that's being done, I think that they need to have interpretations, careful interpretations, by both internal investigation and the prosecutor.
Listeners, have you been following the case of Keith Scott, who was shot by police in Charlotte, North Carolina? Or how about Jesse Bashaw, who was shot in Winooski? In both cases, the public called for local law enforcement to release that body camera footage. We're talking about that topic exactly right now in Vermont Edition. Where do you stand on the use of body cameras? 1-800-639-2211 is the number to call if you'd like to comment or if you have a question for either of my guests. We're going to take a little short break right now, but we'll get to your questions and talk more about police body cameras when we come back. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck, and we're talking today about the pros and cons of police body cameras. You can join our conversation at 1-800-639-2211, or you can post your thoughts on our show page at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. My guests today are Lieutenant Gary Scott. He's commander of the Vermont State Police Williston Barracks, and he chaired the state police's pilot program that tested out the use of body cameras. Stan Chernock is professor of criminal justice and director of the School of Justice Studies and Sociology at Norwich University. And Leah Ernst is a Vermont attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union. Let's go to the phone lines now and talk to Susie, who's calling from Guilford. Hi, Susie. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Nina. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it. I have two thoughts about it. One is, what a fascinating topic. I just never even occurred to me, but I was thinking that the actual technology of the officer that's trying to, you know, do many things to protect the person might be distracted from running the technology. The intro said something about that the officer was out of compliance because didn't start the camera in a specific time. And I think for the, you know, actual help or assistance of the officer to be discouraged or dissuaded because of running the technology or did the camera start or whatever. And the second thought is so much of, you know, civilian calls are made by victims who are really looking for assistance in a state of really despair. And I'd hate for the idea that might be their particular problem might be, videoed and then displayed to public might discourage a victim from seeking assistance when they're in a terrible situation. Like, you know, oh, I'm in this terrible situation, I'm going to call the police. Wait, I can't call the police because then it might end up on YouTube or something
right.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
Right, Susie. Those are my two thoughts.
Yeah, thanks for that call. Interesting points. Lieutenant Scott, let's talk first about Susie's question about whether or not these cameras can become a distraction.
So the in-car camera system that's been there for a while, when the officer turns the overhead lights on, the blue lights, the emergency lights, that automatically activates the system. And then there's a microphone that he has on his belt that he can click over as well. And then the body camera, it had a pretty simple system right in the middle of it because the camera is normally sitting right in the middle of their chest where he would click that over as well. So after a while, it just becomes muscle memory as part of, you know, when you're making a traffic stop or dealing with something. It's just one of the things you do. You know, for troopers, we grab our big hats and put them on and we get out of the car. And it's just sort of that muscle memory that happens.
But then how do you explain a number of cases across the country where the footage mm-hmm. was asked for and then suddenly we find out that, well, the police officer that responded didn't turn on the police camera? I think that happened in Charlotte. Is that an issue that you think needs to be better addressed, Lieutenant Scott?
Absolutely. You know, and, you know, as a fluid situation, they're dynamic sometimes. You don't realize you're in the middle of something that could happen as you're trying to, you know, be conscious of your safety. So that may be something that is overlooked if you're out on the street and all of a sudden, you know, you think someone has a weapon. That may not be the thing you're going to think about first is turning on the camera. So you're going to be thinking about your safety. So, you know, every situation is unique, but the way we would like to have it is sort of that muscle memory, and it's part of the training that we put our troopers through.
And how do your troopers identify to the person they're knocking, you know, the person's home, they're knocking on the door there? How do they identify that they're recording? What was the protocol?
So we do have that as part of our policy, is that when, you know, wherever there is a reasonable expectation of privacy, that our troopers should be letting the public know that they are being recorded. So if we're walking into someone's home, that we will let them know and give them the opportunity to say that they don't want to be recorded, or they don't want to have this used, and so we would turn it off.
How often did that happen where someone said, no?
There were zero cases that I'm aware of.
Interesting. And one more follow-up, because I asked Leah Ernst about this, but I didn't get a chance to pose this to you, Lieutenant. Are you at all worried that people may not call because they know that the officer who's going to show up will be filming?
I don't think so. I think that when people are at that moment where they're calling 911 or resources, they want the situation to stop and they want help to get there as quickly as they can. So I don't see that as a problem, but I understand why, you know, it's in the back of some people's minds that's sort of the climate we're in now, where everything immediately ends up online and is viewed by a lot of other people. So I can see where the concern is.
I came across an article from a policing journal that cited a number of limitations of body cameras that this article felt police needed to keep in mind. And a couple of the points I found really interesting. One was that a body camera is not an eye tracker. It photographs a broad scene, but it can't document where the officer is looking at any given moment. And likewise, the camera can't acknowledge the physiological and psychological phenomena that an officer may experience. Be experiencing under high stress, and that your brain may play tricks on you when you're stressed or tunnel your view. And the point of the report said that, you know, someone reviewing what's caught on camera and judging the police officer's actions later could have a profoundly different sense of what was happening than the officer had at the time it occurred. And I'm wondering, let me ask you, Stan Chernock, what do you think about that?
I think those are excellent points. When a case is going to be brought to court, the body camera is going to be only one factor. I think that absolutely needs to be considered. Also, the cameras are rather limited. They're not always wide-angle cameras. I went to a conference where police in San Francisco were trying to decide whether or not they would use body cameras. They are very concerned about what happens on the sides. And if we don't have a wide-angle camera, what's happening on the side of the police and behind the police? They can't cover everything. That's another type of consideration. All of these would have to be taken into consideration in determining the culpability of a police officer in any given situation. But I think your points are extremely well taken about how the police officer is perceiving the situation, besides what the camera's demonstrating.
Well, let me go back to the phone lines. Leah, I'll let you jump in first. Go ahead. Did you want to say something?
Oh, thank you, Nina. I just quickly wanted to say that the reasonableness or lawfulness of an officer's conduct is judged from the viewpoint of what that officer actually perceived in the situation, not what the camera captured. And as you suggest, those can be two very different things. And that's why, again, it's very important that the officer's initial recollection of the events is untainted by viewing the footage before making a statement. In fact, it could seriously undermine the officer's account if what he or she actually and legitimately perceived gets sort of recorded over in his or her mind by viewing the footage first.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, let me go to the phone lines. We have Steve in Burlington who's been waiting patiently. Steve, hi. Welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Hi. So I'm a business analyst, so I look at things from through the lens of dollars and cents. And I think that most would agree that both the community and the police stakeholders, you would overwhelmingly say that body cameras and car cameras are a good thing. I think that from what the officer was saying before, that that it's $1,200 to equip a body camera and $5,000 to equip a car camera, I think cost then ends up becoming a prohibitive factor. But the first thing I thought of when he was saying that was, you know, I have a car that I race at the track that has a GoPro camera with enough memory for about 3 hours. I have two GoPro cameras, one that attaches to the front of the car, one that attaches to the mirror. And together, they both cost less than $200. If I wanted enough memory for an 8 to 10-hour shift, maybe it cost me $225, and they were designed to withstand a car crash at the track. So I'm not understanding the gap between that existing technology and the $5,000 to put one in a police car. And then my son is a skateboarder who has a GoPro camera that is designed to withstand the rigors of extreme sports, and that cost him $80. So with enough memory to last an eight-hour shift that you then download to a central location, even, you know, I deal with memory storage for my clients, too, and memory storage doesn't create the gap between $80 for a personal body camera that can withstand extreme sports and $200 for a car camera that can withstand a car crash at a racetrack.
Steve, let me pick it up because our time is short, and I think you make an interesting point. Lieutenant Scott, Steve's point is cost. You know, can't you find less expensive cameras, and why are the cameras that are being considered for police squad cars so expensive when GoPros are out there at a much lower cost?
Yeah, you know, we want technology that's going to I hear his point of the GoPro can withstand all of this trauma and things like that, but we need a system that can't be manipulated. We want it to be a simple on and off system for the officer that's involved, and then there can be integrity of how we secure that evidence when it's brought back to the station. It's not going to have the officer that it's involved in it have be the sort of the records keeper of that. It's going to be brought back in and downloaded, and then we have a supervisor that's in charge of that. So we need a product that's going to be able to, you know, withstand that, you know, security and integrity of an investigation. So those are some of the things. We want a system that's going to work with our in-car camera system and, you know, present the best picture possible in both ways. So that's some of the factors that we looked at. And then what he mentioned is the shifts that we're usually working are 12 hours in different type of climate, and getting you're in a car that's warm and then you're getting outside, and we need a camera lens that's going to be able to adjust to the changing climate when you're going in from your cruiser to a snowstorm or to the rain, that's still going to be able to pick things up adequately. So that's part of it. So we definitely looked at different technologies. We had about 20 different companies that did apply as part of our RFI and RFP process, the request for information process. And then we had to narrow it down to the product that worked best for the environment that we're in here.
All right, I want to kind of
let me intone. Actually,
yeah, just briefly, though, Stan, just briefly.
Okay, actually, the lieutenant brought up other costs, too, and those are storage costs and training costs that must be considered besides just the cost of the camera.
Well, and I want to ask just a quick follow-up to Lieutenant Scott. What did you determine with storage of the data? How long are you going to keep these tapes?
That's something for our in-car camera system right now, we hold things for about 4 years, but we've kind of held off now as there's been a change in the environment and how we want to hold this information, what type of situations we're going to hold it for and how long. So, you know, generally criminal cases where we want to keep that longer, but interactions that don't have any type of criminal element to it, we would like to try to get out and delete or, you know, have removed from our system, because that will help us in the long run with costs. So that's something we're still working through right now as we develop our policies.
Let me go to a caller from Wentworth, New Hampshire. Scott, go ahead. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you. Yeah, on this whole camera deal, I want to say one thing after listening to a few people talk about this. Yes, I do agree this is a very complex problem for legalities. But, you know, one of the things I really feel strongly about is that I think that police officers across the nation, every police department should have body cams. One of the most important reasons why is that trust thing you guys were talking about earlier. However, I think it's very important, even through the initial stages of a police officer making contact with any civilian or citizen in the United States, that needs to be recorded. There's too many times that we see across the country, and I've been involved with it myself, where there's a verbal statement given to the police officer. And then when it comes time to give the written statement, the person puts the written statement down, but then the police officer goes back and says, well, his verbal statement doesn't match his written statement. And a lot of times there's confusion in there, which leads to charges brought up on people, which are false charges. I think that these body cams would eliminate a lot of these time-consuming, costly, charges brought against people that really have no fact basis to it, but the person ends up going to court. They have to pay for lawyers, even to get it thrown out of court. Our
All right, Scott, I've got it. I'm going to have to interrupt because we've only got a minute or so left, and I want to give the last word to one of our guests because I think you've brought up some interesting points and they're points that we've heard. Leah Ernst, I just want to give the final word to you since I wanted to bring you back into the conversation. Looking at how this whole issue is sort of evolving, are you optimistic that going forward body cameras can be used in a responsible and ethical way here in Vermont?
I think we have a great opportunity to do so here. The committee tasked with proposing initial policy is working hard to establish best practices, and we're hopeful that what we ultimately come up with will be adopted by the Law Enforcement Advisory Bureau and ultimately the legislature. You know, I think we all in good faith understand the complexities here and are working hard to try to balance all of these competing interests.
Well, this is one of those issues that I'm sure we'll be revisiting on Vermont Edition with future programs. Lieutenant Gary Scott is commander of the Vermont State Police Williston Barracks. He chaired the State Police's pilot program that tested out the issue of the use of body cameras. Stan Chernock is a professor of criminal justice and director of the School of Justice Studies and Sociology at Norwich University. And Leah Ernst is an attorney with the Vermont chapter of the ACLU. And I want to thank you all very much for being on the program today and talking with us about this.
Thank you, Nina.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, fall is here and winter is coming. Time to clean those chimneys and wood stoves. We'll talk with a longtime chimney sweep, David Kehoe, about the best way to do that. Stay with us on Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck. Fall is here and winter is coming. If you have a fireplace, you may well have already used it. I know I have. One thing this means, if you're a chimney sweep, you're probably already very, very busy. David Kehoe has been a chimney sweep for decades. He started Artful Chimney Services in Burlington in 1980. He joins us today to talk a little bit about the chimney sweeping lifestyle. David, thanks for being here.
Yes, you're welcome.
So, I'm curious, how'd you become a chimney sweep?
Well, I was sitting on an oil tanker down in New York City in Brooklyn, and I was laid off for the weekend. I was in the maritime business, and I opened up an issue of Mother Earth News, read about a chimney school in Stowe, Vermont, and I said, wow, that's right up where I live. So, I'm looking at all the people that graduated. They've all got top hats on and tails, and I said, that looks like a cool profession to get into. So I looked into it and slowly got started, went to the school, met a lot of guys from all over the country, and I've just continued to do it since
so,
then.
So what are the keys to being a good chimney sweep? What do you have to do day-to-day as you're doing the job?
Oh, you have to just keep up with a really tough schedule, whether the weather is good or bad or whether you're sick. You know, or something, you've got to work every day because people are depending on you. And your schedule is, sometimes I'm scheduled 6-8 weeks out, and I can't miss any time. I can't miss these people. I can't bump them. So I go out no matter what, even on weekends if I can't get to them during the week. So sometimes it becomes 7 days a week.
And this is a physical, very physical job. I mean, you're climbing on all different kinds of roofs all over the place, I'm assuming.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, it's exciting. You're going down the road in your truck, and you hear the ladders whistling through the wind, and every place you go, it's like a new adventure. So you get there, and it's kind of fun.
And you get a different viewpoint than most people being up that much higher. I know our roof's pretty tall.
Oh, you do. I go on some roofs that are so far up, and now with OSHA, a lot of my places I go, and customers say, "We know you can do it, but you can't do it. You got to do everything with OSHA." So then you get all the harnesses out. And most of the time, I don't have time to rig up harnesses and things. I got to get up there, get back down, get to the next job.
Well, and you know, chimney sweeps, you're cleaning, you're doing the maintenance stuff, but I think you probably also save some lives with what you're doing. I know that when I had my chimney cleaned 5 or 10 years ago, my chimney sweep told me that I'd had a chimney fire and I hadn't even realized it, and so we put a liner in. But how often do you find some pretty dangerous situations that, had you not found it, there could have been real trouble?
Oh, years ago, I went up to a woman's house up in Underhill. I met her at the door. I could smell fumes, and she had a gash on her forehead because she had fallen, and she didn't know what was going on. I found where the pipe had come disconnected in the basement, and she was having me there to do a routine cleaning on her wood stove.
So I got in there. Oh, my God, if I wasn't there, she would have been killed with carbon monoxide poisoning. That was like the worst I'd ever seen.
How often should people have their chimneys cleaned?
You should, if they're burning wood, they should have them checked every year. If they're burning like a fire, a wood stove, or if they're burning more than a cord of wood a year, they should have it checked every year.
Well, and I found it very interesting. When we bought our house, my husband and I, we got a wood stove with the house, which we loved, but we'd never had a wood stove before. There was no instruction manual, and it wasn't until our chimney sweep came maybe 2 or 3 years later and explained all the things we'd been doing wrong using our wood stove. How often do you find you're educating your clients about, well, actually, with the fireplace, you have to do this, or with the wood stove, you need to, you know, kick in that catalytic converter sort of stuff?
Yeah. Most of the time with new customers, I do that. But then I've got customers I've had for years that they've all figured it out, and I understand it, and I feel really good leaving their home. I mean, some people, I'm leaving their house, and I'm like, oh, looking in the rearview mirror, is this the last time I'll see them? They have no clue. But those are people you got to spend a little more time with, and I tell them to call me. You smell anything or you hear anything funny going on. And sometimes I like to check them midwinter, too, if they
so what
make
are
sure.
What are the common mistakes people make with their chimneys? What should you tell listeners right now that are thinking, huh, what do I need to do to check off some of those to-do lists for my chimney?
Once a day, once the chimney's been cleaned, you need to burn it for a half an hour to 40 minutes for hot, really hot for a while. A hot fire a day keeps the fire trucks away,
I'd never heard that.
No, or, you know, keeps the chimney sweeps away or anything. But the main thing is once a day, if you're burning a lot of wood, you've got to burn off all that creosote that's built up when you've had the tail end of the fires the night before. Or so as the fires start going down, they start building up volatile gases and tar in your chimney. So you got to burn it out every day.
And, you know, you said you were busy at the beginning of our interview. Are there enough good chimney sweeps around? Is it a field that if somebody's listening, you'd suggest somebody goes into because there's work available?
Well, there's a lot of us around. There are, but I am like one of the only ones, you know, that works by myself. I've had people working for me over the years, but now everything I look at really closely because there's a lot of liability and there's a lot of things that can happen. And I just don't feel that I can trust somebody else dealing with my customers. Some of my customers I've had for 30, 30, 40, 35 years or so.
And I understand for a while there you were wearing top hat and tails when
you
went on.
up until just a few years ago. You know, 3 or 4 years ago.
I bet your customers loved that.
Oh, they did. A lot of people wanted me to wear at least the top hat. So I used to keep the top hat. Now it's in my office. The tails are kind of hung up. Maybe someday we'll have a big chimney convention and we'll all get together. We can put the tails back on.
So when do you, you know, when does someone hit the ending point of a chimney career? I mean, how difficult is it climbing up on these roofs? Do you see yourself doing this for another 10 or 20 years?
Well, I like doing it. It really keeps me in good shape, and I enjoy doing it. I don't really want to retire. I'm going to have to pretty soon. Right now, I can still swing those ladders around and jump around. I'm 61 years old, and sometimes I think, oh, I don't even feel like I'm 51. But I'm, you know, getting up there.
Well, you've been doing this for a long time. I'm wondering, what's the strangest thing you've ever found in a chimney?
Oh, raccoons or ducks.
Ducks.
I found ducks.
Huh?
I found a mallard duck twice in the same chimney, year after year. Same duck. It's a different duck, but another mallard. So we finally put a cap on, but I thought that was funny.
Yeah.
Now, I guess raccoons. I found a raccoon years ago and got the mother out with the babies, and she took all the babies except one, so I ended up keeping one. He wasn't much bigger than 4 inches, so I raised him till he was a year old and gave him formula and then had to let him go.
Wow.
And then, you know.
All right. Well, David Kehoe, thanks for joining us. I hope I don't find a raccoon in my chimney this year.
No, I hope not. If you do, give me a call.
I will. David.
I mainly will take them out.
David Kehoe is a chimney sweep, owner of Artful Chimney Services. And that's going to be it for our program today. Governor Peter Shumlin will be our guest tomorrow. He'll discuss the health care payment reform plan known as All Payer, whether the Act 46 school district consolation law should be mandatory, and if Vermont needs an ethics commission. You can email your thoughts or questions for Governor Shumlin to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. We have production assistance from Mary Williams, who also directed the program. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels, and our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. From the PEG TV studios in Rutland, I'm Nina Keck. Thanks for listening.